call the first Operations Committee meeting for the year 2020 to order. Could I get a motion to approve the agenda? Mr. Akers and Mr. Forsythe, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Could I get a motion to approve the minutes of the meeting on December 9th? Ms. Arquette and Mr. Forsythe, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Matt. There was some talk about trying to break Greg Paquin's record, so. Matt has a resolution authorizing the chair to sign a contract with New York State Division of Homeland Security Emergency Services Office of Interoperable and Emergency Communications for a fiscal year 19 statewide interoperable communications formula grant modifying the 2020 budget for emergency services. Mr. Lightfoot and Ms. Curran.
New York State Division of Homeland Security Emergency Service Office Interoperable Emergency Communication has awarded a grant of $848,652 to the Office of Emergency Service, which concentrates on improving interoperability in the operable communication systems in the state of New York, with a contract period of January 1st, 2020 to December 31st, 2021. The grant allows the state to provide aid to the county, local municipalities, public safety organizations to enhance emergency response, improving capability, improvements in government structures, operating procedures, infrastructure development, and addresses some SAFECOM guidance with the state homeland security and emergency communications.
Any questions, comments in regards to the resolution? There being none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you, Matt. And Tim LePage, some information regarding electronic home monitoring grant.
So thanks for giving me a minute to speak about this. Ruth said since it's such a short agenda, I have about an hour I can speak about it. So. I know I came to you guys about a month ago and told you that we received another year of the electronic home monitoring grant. With cashless bail coming out, I just wanted to share some concerns with the program. Ruth and I have been discussing it a lot lately. I don't think we're going to be able to hit our milestones. We're just not going to have the interviewed. We're not going to have the screened. I don't think we're going to get the released. So we've been in negotiations with the state. So I had this whole presentation planned I was going to tell you about, and then the state called me after Ruth and I and the operations committee discussed it, pre-committee discussed it. And the state is actually being pretty cooperative, and we may be able to rewrite the way the grant is written. So. First, I just want to review a little bit about the grant. So in 2018, we were able to cover basically all expenses. We ended up with about $600 in profit, quote unquote, after everything was paid for. 2019 was a great year, and I think this would have continued had cashless bail not been enacted. It looks like after all costs and everything associated with it, we're going to have a surplus of about $18,000 in revenue because we did hit all of our milestones. A lot of this is contributed to cashless bail, though, because at the end of the year, all the judges were releasing everybody that we had on home monitoring, so we were getting successful completions and that kind of stuff for it. Right now, we're only supervising about four or five people on home monitoring. And I have a feeling that's going to go down as their sentencing dates are coming up. Right now, it costs about, so Ruth and I discussed it, and our plan originally was we were going to keep this going for another quarter to give it a shot to see what cashless bail is going to look like. Because again, we're just kind of guessing that we won't hit our milestones. Ogdensburg City Court has been, since the beginning of November, trying their new system out and the way they're going to run things. So far, it's been a flop for us. If it continues like that, it doesn't look like we're going to have the screening and everything else. So that's what really made me nervous, is this trial we've had with Ogdensburg. So to run the program for a quarter with just the salary benefits and the $2 on call that we get for the employee gets for carrying the cell phone around after hours and dealing with any after hours issues runs about $20,000. So the reason I originally wanted to talk to you was to say, so we're going to give this a shot. You know, the county may be responsible for about 20 grand if we don't hit the milestones. Not that I think we would be responsible for all the 20 grand, but it would probably be pretty close. So that was my intention, to come and just explain that and say that we wanted to give it a shot and get your backing for that shot for the first quarter to see how we were. Then the state director called me last Friday and said, we feel your pain. We understand what you're up against. We don't think you're probably going to hit those milestones either. So they want to work with us about trying to redo the grant. Whether it has a home monitoring component or not, we're not sure yet. They said we could have a small sliver of it still home monitoring. Well, that's still kind of really expensive because we still have the salary associated with it, the on-call associated with it, and all of that. So we're kind of leaning towards doing away with the home monitoring. They talked about giving us monies for anybody released under supervision from cashless bail, and it'd be strictly just that. We wouldn't have anybody tied to the position where we had a salary to worry about or benefits. It'd be done in-house with the staff we already have, so it wouldn't be any extra. It'd be just basically, I don't want to say profit, but it'd be basically revenue that, you know, wouldn't have to be expended anywhere. So that's kind of where we are right now. I'm waiting to hear back from the state. Our representative was supposed to call us Friday. He didn't, so and I thought he'd call today. So I'm going to call him tomorrow and see exactly what they have in mind. We've got an idea of what we want to do with it. So really, it's kind of up in the air at this point. Like I said, I had a plan on telling you what we were thought we were going to do, and then they kind of said, hey, we can hopefully make this better. So I don't really know what to tell you guys at this point until I talk to the state and see what they're willing to do. I asked just for the $196,000 in cash, and they didn't want to give us that. They still want us to hit some milestones. So unfortunately, they don't want to just cough up the money. And on the agenda, there was, a breakdown on it with where we were, the breakdown of 19 per quarter. You can see the interviewed release, the 60-day completion, and the successful completion. Fourth quarter, those were estimates on where we thought we were going to end. They're pretty close if they're not on. And you can see the breakdown on, like I said, what we profited in 18, 19. And again, 19's an estimate at this point until we see what the bill was for the equipment that we had. And then down bottom was what we are planning on, what we thought the milestones were going to be. We were throwing in the risk assessment, which again, that was going to be kind of just pure profit, because anytime we interviewed anybody, we did a risk assessment on them anyway. So again, I don't want to spend too much time on it because I'm not sure where we're going to go once I talk to the state.
Mr. Akers.
So Tim, what kind of on the ones that were home monitoring now, what types of crimes have they committed?
Could be just about anything. As long as with the grant, it was they had to be medium to high risk to reoffend. That was the big criteria.
And they were all felonies.
They could have been misdemeanors too. The original program started off, it was going to be strictly felonies, and then we weren't getting those numbers either. So the state worked with us, and we were able to bring in some misdemeanors.
Okay. So if I may, we do have the sheriff here. I would like to know what his take would be on the ramifications if we drop the home monitoring program, and what would be, because if we're going to have to make a decision that we may be on the hook for $20,000 plus to maintain this program, I would like to know what on a cost benefit analysis if you're so inclined. He's Brooks is right here. Can you come so, to can you come to the mic or?
So what's your question again?
Well, we're talking about the cost of this home monitoring program, and so one of the options that Tim is talking about is not doing the home monitoring program because of the cost. You're not going to hit these milestones because of the new bail reform and things of that nature. What would be the ramifications if we stop doing any home monitoring at all, as far as your aspect of it from a law enforcement standpoint?
Well, let's use what's your arbitrary number that you're going to say that would come off of that? 5, 4, 5?
Probably.
So four, you're going to have additional, I don't need this mic, you're going to have additional 4 or 5 inmates. Right now, our jail is at 80 right now, as of today. So we got plenty of room to put 4 or 5 people in. That would not, I mean, you're only going to be, you got to think of it like this way. You're going to feed 4 or 5 more people, and you're going to have medical costs for 4 or 5 more people.
So with the new bail reforms and things of that nature, so these are actually sentenced individuals to home monitoring?
Home monitoring is strictly pretrial.
Pretrial.
Yeah. So it could be people that have been sentenced, but they're on pretrial release from like a violation of probation.
Right.
But so, either way, it had to be pretrial.
So would they be eligible for incarceration then?
Under cashless bail, they're not going to be, unless they hit the 3% or whatever of the crimes that can be incarcerated for, or if they've absconded in the past and they've had to issue a lot of warrants for them.
So that's why I'm asking, like, from a public safety
right.
standpoint, Brooks, you know.
It follows the new bail reform. It's going to, whatever crime they commit is going to be the criteria if they fall yeah. under bail. If we don't have this home monitoring, and if they fell under the bail category, it's whatever the crimes are okay. set for statutes that they've set for bail reform.
Right.
I can tell you now, we have, out of 80, we have 21 sentenced inmates in our facility.
Okay.
So you have only a quarter sentenced
right.
in the facility right now. All the rest are waiting, parolees, people waiting for trials, those
okay.
type of those charges. So you only a quarter are only sentenced in the facility right now, which is really a low number for sentenced.
Okay. So. Thank you.
Mr. Reagan.
If someone violates terms of the probation, what happens?
On this home monitoring or on in general?
Both.
So if they violate, we can ask for a warrant, and we can ask that they be held for something, either treatment or held until the violation is taken care of.
That's separate from bail reform. So if they violate probation, it goes in front of a judge. They have a right to still put those individuals in jail. The bail reform doesn't enact with the probation department. It's two separate right. components.
And even with this home monitoring now, if it is pretrial and they violate the home monitoring, they still can't necessarily incarcerate them. So they would just add more conditions to their home monitoring. They may add a curfew, because they're pretty much locked down most of the time anyway, but they might say they have to go to treatment or something of that nature, but they can't incarcerate them.
Mr. Arquette.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tim, did you say that the potential $20,000 shortfall would be experienced over the quarter or longer?
That would be the majority of the cost for the just to do it a quarter.
Okay.
We may recoup some of that depending on if people are released, depending on how many interviews we can squeak out of there, how many compass screenings we do. Again, we're probably not going to get the released to home monitoring, really, unless they're into one of the serious categories, and then is a judge really going to release them to home monitoring if it's that serious? So, like I said, that would be, you know, unless there's a lot of equipment cost too, I'm guessing it'd be around $20,000. And then, like I said, you would subtract whatever we were able to recoup. Worst case scenario, I think, you know, the county would be in for about $20,000.
Any anyone have any additional questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Okay, on to committee reports. As usual, I'll skip myself and wait till the end. Alternatives to Incarceration Board, Mr. Burke.
We haven't had a meeting. We had one meeting this past year.
Okay. Thank you. Board of Trustees for Supreme Court Library, Mr. Haggard.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the next meeting would be scheduled for May.
Thank you. Emergency Medical Services Advisory Board, Ms. Curran.
Our next meeting is the 28th of January.
28th of January. Environmental Management Council, Ms. Terminelli.
We have not had a meeting. We didn't have a December meeting, so we have not had a meeting since the last time I reported.
Inter-County Legislative Committee, Ms. Arquette.
Inter-County did not meet in December, but our next meeting is slated for Wednesday, January 29th.
January 29th. Jury Board, Mr. Sheridan.
Jury Board has not met.
Planning Board, Mr. Fay.
Our last planning board meeting, most meeting was centered around the revival of McDonald's in the camp 5 years on the road. So it looks like present time that we actually let the village of the camp have to decide if they want to take any of our suggestions for the McDonald's, basically, the first traffic.
That's some good news. The Ag and Farmland Protection Board, we have not had a meeting since my last report. And the Fire Advisory Board met on December 19th, 2019. And Director Denner updated some dispatch stats for November. The 9,283 calls altogether. And total calls handled year to date as of December 19th was 97,715. A lot of calls. And he gave a brief update on the towers going up in Hammond, planned for February, Waddington, May, and Governor, June. So that is all I have. Do we have any old business? Any new business? We have some appointments, but that will wait till executive session. Thank you. What's that?
I'll try. Call the January services meeting to order. Is there a motion to approve the agenda? Mr. Forsyth makes the motion. Mr. Fay seconds it. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Carried. Ask for a motion to approve the December 2019 minutes. We got Ms. Kern and Rick Perkins seconds. Is there any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Resolutions. We have a resolution modifying the 2020 budget for the Public Health Department for the immunization program.
and Dana McGuire is going to talk on that. Is there a motion? Mr. Haggard and Kevin Aker seconds. Go ahead, Dana.
Thank you. So this resolution is to modify the budget for the department. The modification has been made already for the grant, but how we have structured our department puts a lot of our kind of programs all into one batch, and so by not modifying now, we just don't have like the money in the proper area to do the spending. So that's what we're asking for here.
Any discussion? Go ahead, Mr. Lightfoot.
Could you go into a little, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you go into a little detail about where these expenses occurred?
Yeah,
and
so,
the reason for them?
Yep, so for this grant, we have so much money at the beginning of the season put towards staff allocation. And at this time, we've had a lot of staffing changes, so we haven't used that allocation. So those funds put towards that have not been used. So we want to change that to put some of the new equipment that we want to order. And three of those big pieces would be chairs for the rooms to give the shots, actually.
Okay. Any more discussion? Mr. Aker?
Dana, could you tell the board what you actually provide, what immunizations you actually provide for the services?
All of them. So we do flu shots, we do the Tdap, we do all of the ones that are just going to be required for the schedule for kids in school. We still do have shots that you can receive to do the traveling, although one vaccine that you need to go, which is the yellow, it's the yellow fever vaccine, is still not in the supply for this area. So that actually has been really down for us, because a lot of people who are going to be traveling need that shot. And so if they can't get that here, then they go elsewhere so that they can get all of them. But we provide all of them. Our main concern, though, is to provide the immunizations to people without insurance. So that is our kind of core, and that is the responsibility that we have just as the local health department.
Any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. We have another resolution authorizing the chair to sign a contract with the Center for Disease Control and Prevention for an Intergovernmental Personnel Act Mobility Program. Oh, motion by Ms. Kern. Larry Denisha seconds it. Go ahead, Dan.
This is just an extension from last year. So I had a one-year contract to work with the CDC. It's actually to do some of the case, kind of like the review. They asked me to stay on for that. It pays 2% of my salary, and it's about 2% just of my time as well. I do maintain the relationship just with the CDC, so it's kind of nice just for some of the questions that I may have as well.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
There is just one thing that I wanted just to bring up. I wanted to bring up kind of an update of just what we have going on with the coroner's program. You, about 2 months ago, passed that we could have a new contract with the Plattsburgh area. They have stopped the service with us. And that was for the first of this new year. And so right now, we just have services from Dr. Livingstone, and he will be on vacation for about 10 days this month. So we will have a time where we don't have any services, and I just wanted you to know that in case there was some cases that came and we couldn't do the autopsies right away. We are working on this. We don't have one of the like the forensic kind of pathologists. So that is still something that we're lacking for this county. And we have about 4 cases that go forward each year. So that is something that we are also working on, but we do have a lack of just of that service. I wanted to make you aware.
Any questions? Very good, thank you.
Yep.
Another resolution modifying the 2020 budget for community services for the Family Counseling Center of Gloversville, New York contract. Ms. Kern makes the motion, second by Tony Arquette. So go ahead, Jay.
Okay, so the Counseling Center of Gloversville is down in Fulton County. We originally got in contact with them through AHI, which is a performing provider system that was in charge of district monies. And they made the connection because they had some additional psychiatry staff that they could make available on a contractual basis. We had originally anticipated this to alleviate some of the need for a locum tenum for the chemical dependency clinics for the MAT prescribing. But at the same time, we had our psychiatrist on the mental health side opt to go down one day from 2 days a week to 1 day a week because she's in a fellowship. So we are going to be contracting with the psychiatric nurse practitioner to fill that gap. And rather than the original plan, which was to provide Suboxone prescribing. So in order to pay for this, you know, we're using the salary line of the psychiatrist, and we also had a part-time psychiatric nurse practitioner, a per diem psychiatric nurse practitioner. So we're using those to pay for this contract. The psychiatrist tentatively expects to return in October.
Any questions? Mr. Lightfoot.
How are these services going to be provided from Gloversville?
Yes. Yeah, we will use our telepsychiatry equipment that we recently received.
Okay.
The SOAR grant.
That's obviously not the best way, or is it? Is face-to-face a better way of providing those services?
I think depending on the age group, I mean, I think probably some of the younger clients that have grown up with technology, that doesn't bother them as much. Perhaps some of the older people, it's maybe a little uncomfortable, at least initially. You know, there was some regulations that you had ahead of a zoom pan and tilt camera so that you could zero in on the pupils, see if they were dilated, things like that. We still have that capability with this new system. The resolution is pretty good, you know, with it. They're big screens. I think in rural areas, a lot of people are looking, you know, to this type of venue to deliver services. So it's not just, you know, our clinics. I think it's become pretty widespread.
Okay. Yeah. If I may.
Yes, Mr.
How was the figure of $50,960 arrived at?
It was based on 1 day a week at $140 an hour, I believe.
Okay, it's not based on the number of actual interviews or contacts. It's based on a day.
It's an hourly rate.
Okay,
yes.
So if they see one patient that day, they're going to get a day's pay, full day's pay for it.
Theoretically, they could, yes.
Okay. Is it likely that that's going to happen where they would see one patient?
I would hope not. You know, I mean, you know, the wild card's always the no-show rates for, you know, for this in all our services.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Jay.
Yes, Mr. Burke.
Jay, can we overbook to compensate for no-shows? I mean, we probably have a no-show rate at least by the looks of this, it's approximately 20%. So would it be reasonable for people that want services to say to them, you know, we can put you on standby and squeeze you in before cancellation.
I mean, we could do that. I mean, we could probably maybe add just maybe one additional person earlier in the day.
Well, it would be good not to, I mean, to Joe's point, when, you know, when you're paying somebody that kind of salary, it's good to make full utilization of.
We had looked at, they have a psychiatrist there, and we had looked at him providing services, but he was at $230 an hour, so.
Anything else? Yes, Nancy.
I'm not sure if I heard you correctly, but did you say that we will have a lapse in treatment with Suboxone?
A lapse?
A lapse. The hours were cut, and is this who does the Suboxone prescriptions?
Right now, we're using a locum tenens, and we're using our part-time medical director, and we're using part of our psychiatric nurse practitioner that predominantly works on the mental health side for the Suboxone patients. So the medical director, I think I mentioned before, is resigning at the end of this month. We bring on a different medical director. Who's not going to provide at this point direct service, so we do have to fill, you know, that gap in terms of what the medical director is providing, but I think he's spending only maybe 2 hours a day in direct service, so we're hoping that we can absorb that.
So this won't be affecting the people that we treat who do need that, the Suboxone?
I don't believe so, no.
Thank you.
Mr. Akers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jay, in the third whereas of this resolution, it states the department is experiencing unprecedented difficulty providing continuity care for individuals due to unanticipated leaves by more than one provider. Could you give us an explanation?
Well, I mean, this kind of goes back to last year where we had someone, it was a provider that went on sick leave and eventually resigned. So that kind of, you know, in terms of the snowball effect, that started us having to look at either contracting with other providers or locum tenens in order to fill that gap. And then more recently with the medical director on the mental health side backing down to 1 day a week.
Okay. Are those in the private sector, are they experiencing the same type problems? Do you know, like people that are providing the same services? Are their numbers larger than ours? Like we're seeing about 600 people between chemical dependency and mental health. So say somebody like Citizens Advocates or United Helpers or something like that, are they experiencing the same problems, or they have people on staff to provide that service?
Well, I think Citizen Advocates is in pretty good shape in terms of their psychiatry time. You know, they're paying upwards between 300 to 350, maybe even more for a full-time psychiatrist at this point.
Okay.
You know, they have, you know, seemingly have the financial backdrop to be able to do that, you know, given that they're pretty diversified. They have a lot of OPWDD, you know, services in addition to mental health and
okay.
chemical dependency
yep.
clinics and things like that, so.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Burke.
Just an unrelated question to this topic, Jay. I'm wondering, as we try to ascertain the level of substance abuse problems in our community and need for mental health services, has the Community Services Board captured that for us? I mean, as legislators, it certainly is beneficial to know the characteristics of the population that we serve, and having an understanding of where the challenges are, some kind of data that we could wrap our arms around. You know, how are we doing in the fight against opioid addiction? How are we doing with mental illness and in some of the charts that I've looked at, they capture housing, they capture a number of other dynamics in the community, and I'm just wondering where the Community Services Board is with that assessment. Again, they have to do the planning, so to do planning, you need a base of data.
Right. So. Well, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, one of the things you try to use, you know, for that assessment is wait times or wait lists, you know, within the county. You know, I've reached out to all of the chemical dependency providers in the county, and they all have wait times of 1 week or less. So it appears that we have relatively fairly substantial capacity for substance abuse services. I mean, we added Governor. Governor is expanding, Governor Hospital through Adirondack Health Systems, or St. Lawrence Health Systems. They opened a clinic last year. They're also trying to expand that chemical dependency clinic. They've also put in for a PAR application for a mental health clinic, an Article 31 OMH certified clinic. They're going through that process. It's a back and forth in terms of, I'm asked to give feedback in terms of their application, you know, things that aren't clear, gaps in services, reviewing their policy and procedures manual. So there's, you know, myself, you have Central Field, and then you have Albany Certification Unit looking at that application. It's been a pretty protracted process. I think, you know, some of their interest came from getting DSRIP monies to embed mental health patients into primary care clinics. And now they're taking it a step further and trying to open a clinic. I think there's a big learning curve in order to do that, you know, from a hospital-based system. River Hospital in Jefferson County has gone through that process. You know, I think they've struggled, but hopefully they're going to be, you know, turning it around and, you know, learning kind of how to put the pieces of the puzzle together to make an Article 31 clinic work. You know, Messina, you know, they have citizen advocates that just came in end of last year. They are, or middle of last year, they are now full-time. I think they're seeing about 110 medicated assistant treatment patients, which is actually, I think, the highest within the county, surprisingly, in the short time that they've been here. It's difficult to get wait times from mental health clinics for whatever reason. There's more stigma associated with it. I think, you know, in terms of the chemical dependency piece, I think having, you know, the public health task force and bringing providers together has kind of opened that system a little bit. I think there's a little better communication. There's not as much, you know, trying to keep secrets. So I really think, you know, and we haven't been successful at it, but, you know, moving from an individual clinic wait list to a collaborative county wait list, because it's not really any individual clinic, you know, that owns the wait list. The county, it's really a county wait list. So if we can get a better handle on that, that would, you know, be good in moving forward. But mental health, for whatever reason, is still rather closed. You know, there are dashboards out there for Drum Regional Health Planning Organization. You know, they post data. That's usually a two-year lag, you know, from 2017. So I don't have that in front of me. I know that in 2017, we were certainly above the state average for opioid use disorder, emergency room visits and hospitalizations. Where we're at with that right now. I mean, it's hard to get real-time data. You know, the emergency rooms have some of that data. You know, I've talked to Claxton at times, you know, asking for certain things. You know, one of them being, you know, how many kids are in diversion at their emergency room. You know, I was getting that information for a while, and now I'm not. So it's just, it's sometimes hard to really.
Mr. Burke.
the provision of services is one element of it, but it somehow doesn't capture how we're doing in this overall with the addiction itself, with substance abuse. And a conversation I had with Larry Calkins, who's the head of the Seaway Valley Prevention, he talks about the vaping epidemic, that is his perception is that that's expanding. The nicotine addiction is expanding. He doesn't have an answer for what our current state of affair is with addiction. He said that it's multifaceted. It's the ERs has some pieces of information. Different entities have some pieces of information, and the responsibility of the Community Services Board is to pull that data together so that they understand the full depth of the problems and then can formulate some kind of an action to address that with the agencies, and they have an oversight responsibility. So again, not to put you on the spot, Jay, but I think, you know, for our benefit, it would be very helpful knowing where we stand with mental illness, addiction, and especially the newer addiction, the nicotine addiction, and how it's affecting our young people.
So when you say where we stand, talking in terms of unmet need, or?
I can't even tell you. I would say unmet need is part of it. It's not just unmet need. It's where we are, the incidence of it, just the incidence of addiction. What are we dealing with at the present time? And again, the planning function of community services implies that you have a base of knowledge that you use to formulate a community action plan. Is that correct?
Well, it is, but I mean, some of that's a universal negative. I mean, some of that you really don't know what the unmet need is until they reach out and ask for services, so.
Well, that's my question. Have we done that?
Have we
collated all the data points that would give us a better understanding of the state of affairs with addiction and with mental illness?
Collated specific to like emergency room visits in real time?
I don't know all the different points that you might take a look at, but I would certainly think that ER visits is one of them. You covered the delivery end of things. You covered the services that are available, but it still doesn't tell us what the overall situation is with substance abuse. So we've got the services. We think we have enough services. I don't know what the assessment is, but if we don't know the full extent of the need, how can we be sure we have enough services? So anyways, I think the Community Services Board should give us the lay of the land as it relates to substance abuse, as it relates to mental illness. They need to have an understanding of the current state of affairs in order to be able to plan.
Dave Forsythe.
Thank you. I told myself a couple months ago I'm going to start keeping these charts right here. I'm glad I did, because I can compare it.
Sure.
Nice, and I think I got a grasp of this. Can you give me an idea why chemical dependency visits dropped off the chart for the month of December? As opposed to, let's say, October, by over 30%. What was that? I'm sorry.
Which
one? Chemical dependency visits per 7 hours. It's got the employee number.
Yep.
The average is a little over three, probably around 3.5. Whereas the average of chemical dependency, when I cross them off, we do it different now, but is so, over almost five, so that's about 30%.
So we are calculating that differently as of this month. When we originally started this, you know, there was kind of a focus on the revenues, and so we were just looking at numbers, and now we're looking more at production. So we switched, instead of counting individuals receiving group services, we're counting the number of groups. So that dropped that production rate.
Okay. So there could
Dave,
be...
Dave, is this, are you speaking to this resolution, or are you speaking to a different matter on the charts?
I'm speaking to the chemical...
Charts.
Second one down,
to the
chemical
charts.
Dependent visit.
But that has nothing to do with this resolution.
Well, it's kind of... I guess, I can wait.
Okay.
I can wait till the chart then.
And we have a couple other people. First, I've got Rita, then I've got Jim, then I'll have you, Dave. Go ahead, Rita.
I just wanted to say that when you're looking at the lay of the land, if you will, and how many mental health visits you're going to get, and I think from the county, I think it's difficult to tell. I know that in Oneida County right now, they're doing a widespread like study that they got some money for to sit down and see how many mental health visits per year they're seeing within the county, how many overdoses they're seeing in the county, how many different things are being used. But I can tell you from sitting out there clinically, you know, if it's an ER weekend, I'm always surprised. I only do one a month, but I'm always surprised at what new drugs they have in January that they didn't have in December, or how many people are coming up positive for things that you would never think of from one month to the next. And the same is true in Governor. When they're seeing people in Governor, the people are telling you what they perceive they're taking. It's not necessarily what's in it. It's not necessarily what they're going to test for. And I think that's a lot of the problem in collecting data to look at what services we need, is that the person who comes in and tells you that they just overdosed on cocaine doesn't realize that they had cocaine and this and this and this and this in what they just took, and that's why it was different for them. So I think that every county that I've interacted with is struggling with getting really good numbers, because I think that it's really hard even for people who are on the ground seeing the patients to truly understand what's going on. I mean, I had a patient that came in that fell, didn't know why they fell. The person shouldn't have been on anything. Their panel lit up like a Christmas tree. You don't even know why they had it. And someplace they had an ingestion that they were really not aware of. So how do you collect all that data? The best thing I've seen so far is Erie County had like a monkey survey thing that people could put a number, just go in and had a code to take the survey so that they could only take it once. And they self-reported like how many mental health services visits they were having, how often they were seeing their person, were they seeing more than one person, what were they using, have they ever felt that they had ended up using something they were unaware of. And it's a lot of data collection, but I think that we don't have any idea really what's out there still yet. And I think it's really hard to, don't you agree, that's really hard to put it together?
Was that a random sample, or are they targeting people already in services?
I think it was a random sample of people, whether, I'd have to look back to see whether it was, they must have had some connection to services to have been able to get that, but the purpose of the number was simply so that that number couldn't be used more than once and you couldn't self-report twice. But it was a lot of data that they got, and they shared when they were just in Oneida County talking about it, and I get the newsletter from there because I practice in Oneida County. But it's bizarre, the data. And you literally, from month to month, there's new drugs.
Okay, Jim?
In terms of the various providers, has there been any consideration to the idea of when someone calls wanting services, if your clinics are unavailable, if there's a week's wait time, refer them to one of the other clinics so that see if there's quicker service available, since when someone is suffering from addiction issues and decides to seek help, when they have to wait, even if it's a week, often that moment passes and they move back into that drug-seeking behavior. And I'm just wondering, since we have several different agencies in the county, and since the task force is bringing them together and having them talk to each other, this provides us with an opportunity to sort of ensure that when someone is ready to seek treatment, that there is a place for them to go.
I mean, I think that's, I mean, I, you know, that's going to be one of my suggestions, you know, in moving forward with the task force, that we look at would be to have more, I guess, an open system and communication as to who does have openings and who doesn't, who can provide that rapid access to care before they drop off and change their mind. You know, some of that, you know, I mean, ideally it would be good to have a electronic dashboard that's, you know, posted somewhere on the internet. You know, then you'd have to have someone responsible with updating that on a daily basis. So, I mean, I think in theory, I mean, that would be great. I mean, and I don't think it's just in the substance abuse. I mean, like, if you have somebody, you know, who's suffering from anorexia and you don't have somebody that has that expertise, knowing that someone, you know, at Claxton Hepburn Clinic, you know, has been trained and is, you know, is has that specialty to be able to, you know, kind of have that fluid referral. I think sometimes, I mean, I think, how do I want to say this? I think waiting lists, you know, at some level, from a fiscal standpoint, are not always a bad thing, because if you have no waiting list and you get a drop in referrals, then you got people that don't have, you know, enough patients, you know, to see. So I'm not saying that clinics are purposefully keeping a waiting list small, hopefully a small waiting list in case there is a, because there is an ebb and flow of number of referrals. But it is a little, you know, you're kind of out on an existential ledge if you just have no waiting list at all, and all of a sudden, for some reason, you don't get referrals for, you know, a week and a half, and you're discharging people, and, you know, your productivity is going to suffer as a result. You know, and at some level, we're having a little bit of that dilemma right now in our chemical dependency clinics. I mean, we're not having, you know, a large, you know, number of referrals to kind of fill up some of the schedules. So.
Dave. Motion call the question by Mr. Haggard and seconded by Ms. Kern. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. All right, let's have a vote. All in favor of the resolution? Favor? And opposed? No opposition, so the motion or the resolution is carried.
So, I mean, one of the things that was added is at the very bottom of page one is chemical dependency weighted face-to-face percentages. So again, you know, I think, you know, depending on the agency and its overhead, that can be anywhere from 60 to 75%. When OMH was here, they were recommending 60%. We set the bar at 72%, which is 5 billable hours a day, and that means face-to-face. However that is configured, whether it's through different permutations of 30-minute sessions, 45-minute sessions, but hopefully wanting to get a, reach a production rate of a total of 5 billable hours a day. So again, you know, the chemical dependency weighted face-to-face is certainly not as close to meeting that mark as the mental health weighted. You know, I will say on the chemical dependency side, that's a little different than the mental health side. They do quite a few groups. And so, you know, the groups, the reimbursement rate, you know, for one group can, is typically and on average, you know, $170, $180 a group. So, and they do take longer. We give them 90 minutes to do a group. They get credited for an hour, according, you know, to this weighted graph. But there is time that they have to, you know, they want to prepare for the group. But then also they have to do the paperwork that's required for X number of group members afterwards. You know, you can do a concurrent group note in group, you know, that kind of summarizes what was talked about in the group. But when it comes to the individual notes and what the person, what they reported or what their level of participation, that has to be done outside of the group. That can't be done concurrently. So they, it does take a little extra time to do the groups. So I'm not sure. I mean, no-show rates, with the exception of mental health, have continued to go down some. On the CD side, one reason for that is, you know, there are a large number of mandated services. So, you know, some of that is because of them being on probation and or parole to meet their requirements. I mean, I think it'll be interesting in moving forward for those that are not mandated and are chronic, you know, more chronic chemical dependency users, particularly of opiates that aren't mandated. There used to be requirements that they participate in group and individual counseling. Those requirements per OASIS, which trickled down from the Department of Health, are going away. So we won't be able to discharge people who typically before would be considered non-compliant and not, you know, complying with the contract, you know, for medicated assisted treatment. I talked with John Wilson from Credo, and they run an Article 32 clinic as well as opioid treatment program. He's already finding that, you know, a lot of people are just showing up for the medication, but not really engaging as much as they once were in the counseling and the treatment aspect of it. So it's not only, you know, I mean, we'll see how that plays out, but it's not best practice, and it also affects productivity. So.
Any questions? Mr. Burke.
Do we take walk-ins, Jay, for either mental health or substance abuse?
We just started doing telepractice amongst, on the CD side, amongst the clinics. So if we have somebody that comes in, fills out paperwork, and wants to be seen that day, and they're will, and maybe they walk into the Augsburg clinic, but the Augsburg staff are with people, but there's a Canton staff member that's available. If they're willing to do it with psychiatry, we can make that happen on same day walk-in. We're just starting that. Another, you know, on the good side, in terms of a positive note, we're also going to be doing home-based telepractice on chemical dependency side. That is just passed this year. So we'll be able to, if they have a smart device in their home and they prefer to have in-home telepractice sessions, we can do that. Some, you know, if there's a snowstorm and someone says, you know, I'm going to cancel my appointment, we can offer them the ability, if they have a smart device, to continue, you know, to have that session without having to cancel and reschedule. So again, we'll see how that works and moving forward. We're just implementing that.
But do we allow walk-ins to be seen? I mean, on the chemical dependency, somebody walks in the door and says, I need services. Would we see them?
If there's availability, yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Any more questions? Mr. Mr. Akers.
Just a few comments. You know, people don't realize it, but the chemical dependency, alcohol is still the largest problem here in this county and many counties. It's about 40%. So while the opioids and the methamphetamine may be getting all the publicity, people are, you know, are struggling with alcohol. It's about 40%. And I really find it ironic that the state is really concerning itself with the vaping, eliminating the certain flavors, while they're trying to move ahead with legalizing marijuana, you know, instead of decriminalizing it. But it seems the movement is for that. I think it'll be one of the agenda items for the governor to legalize marijuana, but yet we're restricting, concerned about the vaping, restricting of the vaping. So we know data is hard to find. We have seen on the Community Services Board, I'm not a member, I'm the liaison, that we do have higher rates than much of the state in as far as addiction and mental health issues. And a large part of that is related to the poverty that we have. Our unemployment level is second to only to, I think, the Bronx. And the rates of poverty, as Chris Rodiz can attest, are very high. We have, at one point in time, I knew that we had over 33,000 people in this population of 111,000 people that were receiving some type of service. So about, you know, almost a third of our population. So we do know that the hospitals and stuff are actually moving ahead. A good example, and I think, John, you were at the meeting where we had the presentation from the CEO of the Governor Hospital about wanting to open up a clinic, and he showed us a radius of 20,000 people within a 15-20 minute drive of the Governor Hospital. And they knew from emergency visits that they had at Canton and Messina that nobody from this population, or a very small percentage of population, was actually from this Governor Nexus, was actually being treated there. So they took a guess. They didn't have the hard data, John, because I remember you asked about where's your data. And I can remember the guy holding up his hands, well, we don't have that. But we know we have this population, and based on this population of 20,000 people, there should be higher rates of people seeking services. So they moved ahead, and I think it's going well. And if it isn't going well, it wasn't taxpayer expense. It was beyond Canton Sam's Hospital's sheet, accounting sheet or whatever. So in relationship to the sheets that that have been handed out by Dylan today, we've got, you see the waiting list is 12 people for chemical dependency. We have 8 employees in your department that are providing chemical dependency that are averaging about 3.5 visits. And there's 12 people on this waiting list. Even if they, each one of those 8 individuals jumped up to 2 more visits per day, we would not have a waiting list of 12 individuals. But just to really summarize, it's really hard to get people to you know, sign up and say, yeah, I'm addicted, and trying to you know, provide services for them if they're not willing to come in. So it is kind of reactive in a way. We know from the waiting list here that either we're not doing a good job, certainly it seems to me the 8 individuals could absorb these 12 people that are on a waiting list, particularly if you have somebody that comes in and says, hey, I spent the grocery money, I'm hooked on heroin, I need help. So I think it's, you know, data is hard to find, I think, John. It's really difficult to find. We do know that we have these high rates. We do know that there's improvement, but they continue to attack the problem, you know. So the hospitals are involved. It's expensive to run emergency room visits. They're moving to provide those services along with other private entities. So
in terms of the wait list, I mean, OASIS just bumped it up. It was 5 days or less to be considered on a quote-unquote wait list, and now it's either next day or the day after that we're kind of responsible to try to get them in the door. So all these people that are on this quote-unquote wait list have appointments. It's just either not the same day or next day.
Any more questions? Thank you. Okay. One of the county administrator's report.
Thank you.
Yes, just 6 items since we were together just 3 days ago. Wanted to mention, as you are all notified today, that on Wednesday, January 8th, The Jones Road recreational bridges will be open to the public. The DOT is being notified, and highway crews will make sure that they're signed properly. At the Finance Committee next week, we'll bring you an extension resolution. You'll recall a couple of months ago with regard to Barb Lashway, who's taken over for the one-stop working in conjunction with WIOA. We have extended our leases for the year, so that would bring us to June 30th. We'd like to do the same with the one-stop operator. If you remember, a few years back, we separated out the function of the one-stop career center operator, and that contract, I believe, expired in 17, and we'll bring you an update to that, to renew that just through the end of June on the federal year, and then we'll bring a new one to you prior to that. Vacancy Review Committee is scheduled for tomorrow at 3 o'clock. There are 12 vacancies to review, and as of December 24th, there were 53 positions of 789 vacant. That is excluding the seasonal positions. If you didn't see the notice, the IRS mileage rate has been released, and for 2020 is 57.5 cents per mile. I believe that's a half a cent lower than 2019. The forms that you provide to us for mileage submission will be updated to reflect the change. You did receive the invitation in your email, but I wanted to mention the midwinter gathering that you'll be sponsoring will be held at Sergi's in Potsdam on January 19th, I believe, or 17th, I'm sorry. Let us know if you can join us. This will be for an employee recognition evening. It's 5:30 to 9 o'clock. And we'll be providing food and non-alcoholic beverages and a whole host of giveaway type things. There'll be music. We've invited the staff. So we hope you can join us. Let us know so we can have an accurate count. Also, we have adjusted in negotiations this week so that they are with CSEA, the bigger unit, and they will take place Wednesday and Thursday to arrive at 12:30 if possible for negotiation team members to begin at 1 o'clock.
Thank you. Time for committee reports. Board of Health, Mr. Akers.
We'll be meeting on the third Tuesday of this month, which I believe is next week, and the same with Community Services.
Thank you, Kevin. CDP Board of Directors, Mr. Lightfoot.
That board meets the 15th at 9 a.m. Here in Canton. I'll give you a report after that.
Thank you. Community Services Board, Mr. Akers.
Next Tuesday also, along with the Board of Health. They're back-to-back.
Okay. Office for Aging Advisory Board, Mr. Denisha.
No report since the last one, because our last meeting was November 4th. But our next meeting is Monday, February 10th, in the Human Services Building on 310.
Thank you. Youth Advisory Board, Ms. Terminelli.
There has not been another meeting, nor is there one scheduled, but I'm sure we'll have an update to that soon.
Thank you. Any old or new business, Mr. Akers?
At the last finance meeting in December, I had announced that we would have a slot on the agenda for talking about a public discussion about sales tax, and I'd like to take that off the agenda for finance. I'd like to wait until we have more information about what's coming out of the Albany for our budget. We do know that we have been, our Medicaid has been reduced in 1% by some capacity. We know that the state has a $6.1 billion deficit, and I think it would be premature for us to have a discussion about sales tax. What we want to do for the next 10 years, unless until we have some indication of what the state intends to do.
Thank you, Mr. Akers. Any more old or new business? Okay, let's go to, is there a reason for executive session?
Yes.
Okay, for what purpose?
Litigation
and
negotiations.
Personnel as well.
Specific nature.
Okay. And what's that?
Appointments.
And appointments. All of the above. So, who makes the motion? Mr. Rita Kern makes the motion. Larry Denisha seconds it. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried.